a verse of scripture if you guys want to turn to kind of set the tone. It's kind of the apologist's verse of scripture. Peter says, "Be always ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and with fear." So this is what we call intellectual virtue or intellectual honesty, very important attribute of the Christian life. Is that we as Christians, we don't hide behind rhetoric. We're not manipulators. And also, we are people who recognize we have been given a mind by God. God created our rational faculties of thought. And Jesus said we ought to love God with our minds, right? And so the development of our mind, critical thinking, is an important aspect of the Christian life. And when that is diminished, the power and strength of our Christian witness and our Christian life individually will be weakened and compromised. And this is precisely where we are today. So before we jump right into the topic that we're going to be talking about for the next 4 weeks, homosexuality, I want to give a little kind of introductory kind of discussion to set some context for that. I think everybody probably here understands where we are culturally, and it's a mess. Homosexuality is probably the issue that dominates, not just the headlines and so much of the talking points of popular culture, but I think it's the most important and critical issue facing the church. And you can't overstate what has happened in our nation in terms of a shift in values, a shift in our ideology. But before we jump into tackling that subject head on, because the fact is we need to confront it, and we need to know how to answer and respond intelligently and persuasively to those who are promoting homosexuality on all fronts, on all levels, and all aspects. And thus far, we've not done a good job of that. So the point that I want to make is that, one, we as Christians, we need to learn how to do this. We need to take it seriously. We need to develop our ability to speak on this. And secondly, I want to make the point that this is not an isolated thing. Homosexuality is not the root problem facing us. And it's important that we don't spend all of our time chopping off the branches of the tree, when really there's a root issue that we need to really get down to. And we're never going to see the kind of change in our society that we want to see until we get to the root of the problem. Homosexuality, no pun intended, is merely the fruit of the problem, okay? But it is not the root of the problem, right? And so the problem that we face, I want to read you from Francis Schaeffer. How many of you guys ever read anything by Francis Schaeffer? He was definitely a huge influence on me. I know Matt also was heavily influenced to him, and even got to meet him. And he was had passed away before I became a Christian, but I read a lot of his books. My dad has several of his books, and this is probably my favorite book by him. It's called A Christian Manifesto. Anybody ever read this book, A Christian Manifesto? If you've not read it, I would strongly encourage you to get it. It was the last of, I think, probably 30-some books that he wrote in his life. And this was his last book towards the end of his life. Kind of summarized his thinking and what he had seen as he was growing old and has lived for a long time, fighting a lot of the same battles we've been fighting. So he died in, was it 1982, I believe, or 84? So he starts off the book here in the first chapter, and he says, that chapter one is entitled The Abolition of Truth and Morality. And he says, the basic problem of the Christians in this country in the last 80 years or so, in regard to society and in regard to government, that they have seen things in bits and pieces instead of totals. They have very gradually become disturbed over sexual permissiveness, pornography, the public schools, the breakdown of the family, and finally abortion. But they have not seen this as a totality. Okay, homosexuality wasn't yet really on the radar screen at that time, but certainly abortion was a big issue that he was involved in fighting, and he kind of woke up evangelicals to get involved in that fight, which part of that was really primarily just Roman Catholics. Speaking out on that. He says, but they have not seen this as a totality, each thing being a part, a symptom of a much larger problem. They have failed to see that all of this has come about due to a shift in worldview, that is, through a fundamental change in the overall way people think and view the world and life as a whole. This shift has been away from a worldview that was at least vaguely Christian in people's memory, even if they were not individually Christian, towards something completely different, toward a worldview based on the idea that final reality is impersonal matter or energy shaped into its present form by impersonal chance. They have not seen that this worldview has taken the place of the one that had previously dominated Northern Europe, European culture, including the United States, which was at least Christian in memory again, even if the individuals are not individually Christian. So his point is to say that all these subjects that we all are bothered by, they're all the result of, the fruit of, a shift, an underlying shift in how our culture sees reality. A one world view, the Christian worldview, the sort of Judeo-Christian worldview we hear about, which dominated American culture, even though America was not a Christian nation in the sense that an overwhelming majority of people here were Christian. Because the fact is, America, even in its origins, has had a lot of problems, right? And has a lot of things that were not Christian. But it certainly was heavily influenced by Christian values and by a Christian worldview. A Christian view of morality shaped much of American culture and government and law and popular culture. And so really over the last 100 years, that has changed dramatically. Evolutionary theory, of course, the influences of the Enlightenment from France, and which spread across Europe and came to this country. And really there has been a battle between Enlightenment rationalistic thinking and humanistic science and traditional Christian thinking in this country since its inception. And what many people don't realize is that not only was it a battle of ideas, it was a battle of morality. And central to the Enlightenment was not just replacing what they saw as tradition and mythology, Christianity, with reason and science, and liberating the masses from religious bigotry and religious persecution. They also saw sexual freedom, sexual liberation, as a huge part of what they were doing. France has long since been known for its decadence. And so that's a part of the Enlightenment and its influence in our society. I mean, you ever study the Enlightenment and are familiar with what that movement was about, I'd certainly encourage you to do that. You can simply Google the Enlightenment. You can read many, many pages about that. But it was basically a movement that began in the 1700s. Really, 1600s is when much of the intellectual foundation of it began. But it was after the Reformation and the Renaissance, where we were coming out of the Dark Ages, and there was this revival of learning and knowledge. And the printing press, of course, advancements in science, guys like Newton and Copernicus, Kepler, some of these folks. There was advancements in learning, and this was made way because the sort of monopoly of the power of the Roman Catholic Church was broken up through the Reformation. And so we saw the rise of what we call the nation state, where individual nations began to have some autonomy from the Catholic Church, and so there was more religious freedom. And so people began to explore, and they began to publicly express dissent to the church and all these kind of things. And so many nations, of course, underwent the influence of the Reformation. England started the Church of England. Germany became predominantly Lutheran. In France, as in several other nations, the Reformation was beat down by the Catholic Church, and there was not significant reform made. And so in France, there was this huge animosity towards the church that was building and building and had not had an expression in the Reformation. The French Huguenots, they were the French reformers there, they were basically exterminated. And the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre was one of the pinnacles of that, where they said blood flowed through the streets of Paris, and Catholics just began to go through the streets of Paris and just drag Protestants out of their homes and just slaughtered men, women, and children in the street. And so there's a young man who witnessed that, who was an influential writer named Voltaire. Anybody ever heard of Voltaire? And he was just kind of a young skeptic, and he said that horrified him so much he wanted to devote the rest of his life to destroying what he saw as the injustices of the Catholic Church. And so he was one of the fathers of the Enlightenment, along with some other guys that we don't need to really get into, but the basic three pillars of the Enlightenment would be, one, the replacement of Christian or religious belief system and ideology the sort of epistemological foundations of society, what you really base your beliefs on, what your claims to knowledge are based on, your world view. That was replaced. The Christian view of reality was replaced with this exaltation of science and reason. And they said that we don't need religion, we don't need tradition, we don't need to look to the wisdom of ancient civilizations. We should look to science and reason, and we will progress as a people once we've thrown off the oppressive forces of religion. And so that was one of the main pillars. Another main pillar was religious freedom, and that was probably a good thing. They championed religious freedom. So men like Thomas Paine, who was an influential founding father in our country, wrote the little book Common Sense, certainly is very influenced by the Enlightenment. Benjamin Franklin as well, Thomas Jefferson, were all influenced by the Enlightenment very heavily. Certainly not, none of those men were what we would call devout Christian men, although many of our founding fathers were. Okay, so it's important to understand this influence. And so a third pillar of the Enlightenment was, as I said, sexual liberation. There was this huge obsession and this huge desire. And this is not as promoted as heavily, explicitly, to say we just want to be able to have sex with who we want to be able to have sex with. That doesn't sound quite as noble as, you know, religious freedom and championing reason and these kinds of things. So but that was there. It certainly was there and has been a major force in the Western world since the founding of our nation. And so through the 1800s, of course, America was characterized by Christian morality, and that stuff didn't really fly here. There was regions of our country where people would go and do things, but the vast majority of the population didn't accept the kind of perversion that was going on in much of Europe. Even Thomas Jefferson, denouncing European morality, said that when we become as built up and as overpopulated and as crowded in our cities as Europe, we will become as corrupt as Europe. But he didn't think we were as corrupt as Europe. He thought we were certainly much more noble people, and a lot of that was related to our sexual practices. Strong value on marriage, and a real honor and respect of women and sexual purity. That was a huge part of America's success, America's virtue, and our prosperity and freedom as a nation. So fast forward here to the 1900s, early 1900s, of course, we know that evolutionary theory is becoming very prominent. And we have technology, the Industrial Revolution, and some new industries emerge. Some of them are what we know as the entertainment industry, right? So in the early 1900s, film and recorded music become novelties. Nobody really had this at all in history prior to this, right? If you go back through thousands of years of human civilization, people didn't have recorded films. And they didn't have recorded music that you could just play and listen to over and over and over again as a tremendous tool of manipulation. And so the early music industry and the early movie industry, oddly enough, not coincidentally, both really blossomed in Los Angeles, of all places, and which is also the hub of the porn industry and everything else. But there was a disproportionate number of atheists and folks who really advanced this idea of sexual liberation. And anybody ever seen the movie Hugo? Mm-hmm. Kids movie? Okay. I didn't like the film. Some people I know really liked it. They didn't like the fact that I criticized it so strongly. But the movie Hugo is basically a celebration of everything we're talking about here. It's a celebration of the triumph of what I call, you know, the Luciferian occult perversions of Hollywood. And that's really what it was. It was about a man. It really wasn't about it. This little orphan boy and the wonderful little, advancement of computer-generated technology, which is what was kind of hailed as. It was really a celebration of film and the power of film to create reality. And so it was a movie that was predominantly computer-generated images, and so it was a neat film to watch. But the movie celebrated, really, a guy named Georges Méliès, or I don't know how you pronounce his name. It's a French name. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. But it celebrated this guy's life. And who he was, I actually did a little research on it and was kind of intrigued by the film. And it was just a weird movie. It kind of seemed to go nowhere. And it's like, where the heck is this movie going, you know? Start out this little orphan boy who you feel real sympathetic for. And it's really neat graphics and visual, cinematography and stuff. And then it kind of just takes a weird, bizarre turn. You're like, where is this movie going? And it celebrates this strange guy. And you're like, is this a real person, you know? Anyway, it celebrates this guy who was one of the innovators of film, and he made hundreds of films in 1904, 1905, up until around 1909, I believe. And so this movie celebrates his life and what an innovator he was, and not really thankful, not really blessed that movies are the kind of thing they are today, where they really shape our culture and they can inculcate values of all kinds to us, and they really do create reality. And so the themes of this man's movies in the early 1900s were things like there was always some sort of trick, you know, because it was moving pictures, and he was trying to showcase what you could do through moving pictures. You can trick people. They think that they're seeing something, and they're not really seeing what's actually there. And so the ability to trick the eye was a novel thing. But almost always in his films, over half of his films, he was the lead character, and he always played Lucifer. Explicitly, he was Lucifer. And he always tricked somebody. And that was always kind of the catch or the punchline of the film, was Lucifer tricking somebody and pulling them into hell or sucking them into something. And almost always his wife was featured in the film as some sort of seductress who used sexually provocative imagery to allure and seduce and use the tricks of film to seduce somebody into hell. That's interesting, isn't it? The occult imagery and occultic stuff was everywhere in his films. And he even had a film that was known for showcasing homosexuality in the early 1900s in sort of slightly masked imagery with the sun and the moon. And so provocative, to say the least. And you say, well, how could that be popular in this country? Weren't we like this bastion of conservatism and moral probity in the early 1900s? Well, much of America was, right? Most Americans didn't have even electricity at that time. So most Americans weren't watching these Hollywood productions. It was more of an elitist club, right? But even at that, as it began to permeate through the culture and influence the culture, Americans became shocked and horrified by what they saw in Hollywood. So much so that Hollywood actually fell into gross disrepute. And in the late 1920s, they were on the verge of going bankrupt as an entire industry because Americans had pretty much rejected them. And so they actually hired a Presbyterian minister to come in and write a moral code for them. How many of you are familiar with this? The Hays Commission, it was known as, and they hired a Presbyterian minister to come in and to devise, because they weren't capable of doing it themselves, just as they still aren't today. They tried, you know, it's funny, I have some friends that work as marketing guys in Hollywood, and they laugh because they say that they talk to these guys about making family-friendly films. They don't even know how to do that, you know. And they screen these films to them, and they're like, you need to take some of the stuff out of here. This isn't family-friendly. And they're like, well, what? What's not family-friendly? Maybe like the 85 F words and like the naked women. Yeah. Maybe that's, you know, oh, really? So, you know, disconnected. People who just live in a world of such debauchery, even when they want to try to be family-friendly, they don't even know how, okay? And this was the case going back into the 20s. So this Hays Commission was enacted, and you can read it. Type in Hays Commission, Google that. And I'd encourage you to do that, write that down. A really fascinating thing to read. And some of the moral code in there was really incredible. You couldn't make a minister of the gospel look bad. That was one thing. You know, nothing sexual or seductive. Nothing to make somebody sympathetic towards a criminal or a lawless person. Nothing to make anybody sympathetic towards somebody who was promoting sin. And it used that word, sin. This was all in this legal, in this code that Hollywood adopted. And what that blossomed into in 1930, and then it was codified in 1933, was the FCC, what became, you know, the Federal Communications, whatever. And they began to regulate all that. And so that was kind of the law of the land. And, you know, so there was this kind of restraint put on Hollywood where they tried to really abide by these movies, and they wouldn't produce a movie unless they had this. There was always an underground of trash produced even back then. There was a porn industry even back then. But that was kind of, you know, and so we, you know, all these great movies we think of the 40s and 50s, you know, virtuous films and stuff. The first film to be produced without the FCC's approval was a film called Some Like It Hot. Anybody know, ever seen that film? I think it was 1957 or 1959. Marilyn Monroe. And on the cover of that film, there's two men underneath her and her skirt's getting blown up and she's trying to hold it down. And there's two guys dressed in drag underneath her looking up, attempting to look up her skirts. And so that was 1959. And that was the first film that the FCC would not approve of it, and they released it anyway, promoted it anyway, and by that time they had pushed the envelope so much. Subtle little things, subtle little seductive images, so many little seductive things to titillate, you know, and titillate the minds and imaginations of people, to really seduce people. And so at that point, just basically the doors were blown off, and the FCC basically lost a lot of its power and influence, and the floodgates were opened. And so the 50s were already a time where rock and roll had emerged as this dominant force in our nation. And several factors converged in the 50s. We had newfound prosperity. You know, we came out of World War II. We emerged as a world superpower, a manufacturing superpower. And we had tremendous prosperity. And so the suburbia was really built in the 50s, right? Prior to that, you didn't really have what we know as suburbia today. You had this sprawling suburbia that built up, where teenagers now had unprecedented freedom, time, leisure, and opportunity. And that was heavily exploited. Automobile industry became prominent, and most young people at that time, when they got their first vehicle, prior to 1950s, most young people never would have had a vehicle or owned a vehicle. Didn't have the money or the means, you know. It was very much a luxury item. In the 50s is when the average kind of teenage young boy could be riding around in his automobile, right? and with no particular place to go, right? Just with his little lady in the seat next to him, full of passion, with nothing but a radio. And so who had power over the minds of these young people? Who controlled that radio? And so this whole industry of music and radio technology, and the people that controlled the stuff were people who were, again, disproportionate number of strongly anti-Christian, ungodly, very anti-Christian morality, huge champions of sexual liberation. And you can see it in the songs, you can see it in the music of the 50s. The music of the 50s is not innocent and sweet. I was just looking at a song today that a friend of mine played for me called School Days by Chuck Berry. Anybody familiar with that song? And what is that song about? I asked several of my friends what's this about, and they said, it's about school. This song is not about school. Yeah, it's an older man and corporate executives who create this and craft this and market this to teenagers. And the song is about how school is lame, which it is. And so the only thing they want to do is get out of school, and they rush down to the jukebox where they can dance and make romance. And he uses that term, make romance. And he throws some sexual innuendos in there. He talks about how the rock and roll just is like electricity from head to toe. Making romance. And then he says, hail, hail, rock and roll. Making romance with the one I love. It's a great message for the teenagers at that time, isn't it? Hail, hail, rock and roll. Let it electrify you from head to toe so you can make romance with the one you love. And that's all. And he says that's all you were thinking about all day long while you're in school. It's the lyrics of the song. You can read that. That's a good song for our kids in the 50s, right? So you think of the effect this was having on teenagers who, some other converging factors at that time were high school itself. Why was there a song called School Days? That was, again, a novel thing. The majority of kids didn't go to high school up until the 50s. That's when really the majority of kids were sent to high school. This kind of idea of putting them into high school was kind of developed, and really it had been around, but the mass factory school system as we know it today. But really it was in the 50s is where it really kind of became mainstream, with the vast majority of even Christian parents fell for the lie of, hey, somebody else will pay for my kid's education? Boy, that's a great idea. And they ship their kids off to the public school system. And even at high school, so rather than your 13 or 14 or 15-year-old kid working on the farm, as every prior generation had pretty much been doing, or working in a factory, as some had started to do with industrialization, your kids, didn't work. They went to school. And they hung out with a bunch of their peers in this little nanny state sort of system, where they became, open game to the marketers and purveyors of the entertainment industry. They had the money to spend. They had the time. And there was not supervision, right? Because they were, prior to that, you wouldn't supervise your 14 or 15-year-old kid. You're expected to act like an adult. You're entering the workforce. You're moving forward in your career, right? There was no need to babysit a 14 or 15-year-old kid or supervise a 14 or 15-year-old kid. Well, now suddenly there was. And so all this converged in the 50s, and where this all has led to then is, of course, what we know, this building tension and building pressure and this building thing of what exploded in the 60s. Which didn't just emerge out of nowhere. This is why I'm giving all of this context, so we understand that there was huge shifts in the way people thought. Christianity and the worldview, the essential pillars of truth, the basic foundational ideas that there is a God, that He is just, that He is holy, that we are under His authority, that our freedom comes from Him, that our dignity comes from Him, that our morality comes from Him, that He designed male and female, that we have certain gender roles, certain gender distinctions, that marriage is an institution He created, producing children in that covenant of love and fidelity, that all these kind of pillars of the Christian worldview were gradually, one by one, eroding. The 20s and 30s, of course, divorce and adultery and these things. On into the 40s and 50s, fornication becomes normal. By the 60s, it's just a free-for-all, right? And this thing just explodes. Not by accident, again, very much by design. There were intelligent, well-funded people crafting strategies and marketing campaigns to see this accomplished. But it exploded in the 60s with what we would know as the sexual revolution. And so the sexual revolution has emerged on us as a nation. Our value system literally flipped upside down. And it wasn't just sexuality, it was every ethic imaginable. It was the philosophy of do what you want to do, right? Do as thou wilt, as Aleister Crowley put it, and as was repeated in so many songs of the 60s, especially those imported from England, bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. So this message of do what you want to do literally just turned our nation upside down. And the mantra that was still kind of there in the 50s, God, family, country, was replaced in the 60s with sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? and it unleashed absolute havoc on our civilization, to the point that today, as you look around, it is a disaster beyond disaster. The vast majority of young people in today are literally incapable. Not just that they won't, it's that they are incapable of having a long-term committed relationship. That is just a statistical fact. That's not a judgment from some right-wing, narrow-minded Christian. That's a statistical fact that people all across the spectrum see and recognize as a problem. They don't know. They cannot maintain long-term relationships. Family has disintegrated. So the norm is now broken homes, abused, neglected, abandoned, or aborted children has become the norm. And family has broken apart. Sexual ethics have increasingly just been thrown out the window, to the point that, of course, now we're sitting here talking about homosexuality. 17 states have legalized homosexual marriage now, which is highly disturbing. It's being taught in our schools. Many states in this country, children are getting textbooks promoting the experimentation with homosexuality. Children are being adopted into homosexual families. We even have the situation like we saw where a transvestite, a man, who thinks he wants to be a woman, but he's still a man, but he dresses like a woman and adopts a female name, can go into a female bathroom or a female locker room where little girls are changing, and he can expose himself, and he's protected. And if you don't like it, you need to leave, and you need to get your child out of there. But he has a right to be there. So this is the point to where it has come to in our nation, where now Christian businesses and Christian churches that are going to begin to see their tax-exempt status lost, begin to see their licenses revoked from the state because they do not embrace, welcome, and accept and affirm homosexual behavior and practice. And so it is now being forced upon us as a nation. The culmination and climax of all this sexual deviancy that has gone on is now going to be forced on us as a population. And they are going to mandate that this is taught to our kids. And if you don't accept this, your children will be taken from you. And so much of this is already here, much of this is already being talked about, and certainly much more is coming down the pike. Matt has talked about the onslaught of what we're soon going to see, the acceptance of pedophilia. Now, some people kind of say, never. That could never happen. Bestiality, that can never happen. But the point is, of course, it's an inevitability. When you understand the presuppositional issues, when you understand that the theological foundation has been destroyed and what it has been replaced with, there is no standard. There is no standard whatsoever. There is no one to say what is right and wrong sexually. All that we have heard for the last 50 to 60 years is people are free to do what they want to do. You cannot judge somebody else's sexual choices. That is love. And you cannot judge in how another person chooses to love. Right? And so there is no standard. So the question is not whether we'll see pedophilia or not. The question is, why wouldn't we see pedophilia? Why wouldn't we see bestiality? Because we have no basis upon which to say it's wrong. And the fact is, there are many, many, many people who are already embracing it. Every day we read about lawyers, doctors, school teachers, professors, principals, politicians, people of influence and high education who are arrested because they had child pornography on their computers. Tons of it, right? Some of these people have, libraries of this stuff. And so these are people that people sit, these are people of influence who are looking at this stuff every day. And it is pervasive. So the only question is why wouldn't they? And there's no, it's an inevitability that we will see it. They will follow the model, the plan of the homosexuals, who when it was an unthinkable act in the 50s, most Americans did not like homosexuality even when I grew up. The word fag was a common word to come out of my mouth to most of my friends. And it was not a term of endearment, okay? And so that was, I graduated in 96, and I went to school in four different states, big cities and small towns, from upstate New York to New Orleans to California to Florida. And I don't ever remember seeing an open homosexual kid in high school. And he would have got punked out really bad if he would have, done that. And anybody who even acted effeminate generally got punked out. That was not acceptable, right? Even if you were not real masculine, you at least tried to be, And so that was even just going back in 1996, right? And so much has changed. Now you go to a high school, you pass out tracts at a high school, again, from city to country, big town to small town. You will see a huge number of openly homosexual kids who are militant, who are seen as martyrs and victims, who we ought to sympathize with, who are protected, esteemed, and to where the point where bisexuality has actually become a fad that is popular in many of our schools, even now in middle school and elementary school. We're now seeing elementary school kids celebrating diversity. So this is what is upon us. And again, it's an inevitability. As Schaefer talks about, there is a shift in the fundamental worldview of our society away from the Judeo-Christian one towards one that says truth is ultimately unknowable. All we really know is what reason and science tell us, which basically tell us that we evolved from lower life forms. We are the random products of evolutionary forces. We don't know if there is a higher intelligence out there or not. It's beyond our ability to answer through reason and science. And so nobody knows. And so therefore, you create your own value system. You create your own system of spirituality or religion or philosophy. And everybody's is equally valid because they're all equally untrue. None of them are really true with a big T. We all just kind of have our own truth. And so we just need to tolerate and accept that everybody's different. Nobody really has any kind of ultimate knowledge about these questions. So it is a complete free-for-all. And so there's no limit to where that depravity will take man. There's no limit to where that depravity will take our culture. Again, these folks that are advocating for pedophilia, they'll follow the same model that the homosexuals followed. Again, 30, 40 years ago, it was unthinkable. 20 years ago, it was not popular, not talked about. And yet it was there under the surface. They were moving, they were strategizing, they were scheming, they were putting themselves in positions of influence, and they began to emerge out of the closet. They began to use their positions of influence to propagandize our nation. And the pedophiles will follow the same suit. And more we're going to start to see some of their propaganda coming forth from places of respectability. And it's going to start to force itself upon us. And it's coming. So, again, it's an inevitability. But also, homosexuality was an inevitability. Once the foundations of Christian morality, the idea that sex is a sacred thing, preserved for family, marriage, production of children, these things were tied together. Once we divorced sex from marriage, family, and children, homosexuality was an inevitability. And so it's important we understand this foundational stuff. Okay, anybody have any questions at this point, anything that I've said? So what have the homosexuals done? What they've done here is they have crafted a very clever marketing campaign to change public opinion. In the 90s, there was some books written and some people got together to basically come together with some really powerful marketing strategies to get Americans to accept homosexuality. A lot of research, a lot of data was put together to identify emotional hot button phrases. We all have certain little phrases that will kind of get us, right? And there are marketing and research analysts who their whole job is to simply find out what those things are. Google's a master at this, right? And this is where all the things where they can bring products right to your doorstep. You wonder why you have certain ads on your right screen of your thing when you're on Google Chrome or whatever? It's because marketers have already linked to you guys by certain words you've typed in, certain sites you've visited. They have these databases that gather all that information. They run these algorithms and they analyze all that. And they're able to determine an awful lot about you, things that would amaze you. Target was able to analyze women, whether they were pregnant or not, simply by looking at things. They're just able to analyze certain things that they were buying or things they were not buying, things like unscented lotions, a higher purchasing of unscented lotions versus scented lotions, all these different kind of things. They're able to put that data together and they were able to figure out consumers going on their website who were pregnant. And so then they were able to send special coupons, special advertisements, for pregnant women to that. Right? So that's just some of the kind of marketing power that exists in our world through the power of digital age. So some really brilliant people were utilizing this stuff, and they figured out what kinds of things would work to change public opinion about homosexuality. And so here's an example of some of what that looks like. This is Newsweek magazine. This is from March 1st, 2004, okay? So I don't want you to look at Donald Trump. That's probably not the best picture he wants shown of himself. But Here's an article about homosexuality. This is when they were performing gay marriages at the Capitol. I mean, I'm sorry, at the courthouse in San Francisco, City Hall. Now, that's a wonderful picture there, isn't it? Doesn't that just warm your heart? These two handsome, well-dressed, professional guys with their adorable little babies, they just want to be loved. And of course, but there was protest. And here's one of the protesters. He might look a little familiar to you. And it's me. But he, now notice the picture here. The camera's beneath me. They got a picture of me. I was just talking normally, but you know, they obviously found the right picture. My mouth is open. I looked angry, and they're down underneath me like I'm this menacing villain. Contrasted with these beautiful little men who just want to hold babies and love people, and they're just clean, happy, professional people. So, brilliant marketing. They create a reality here. This has powerful emotional content. And you can flip through, and there's dozens of pictures of just, I mean, they're literally glamour shots. I mean, these are staged, professional photos. These people have makeup on. Okay, I was there at the courthouse. It was Sodom and Gomorrah. There were, you know, 7-foot transvestites in Speedos. I mean, there was people spitting and foaming at us. There was, I mean, just debauchery. But they didn't show any of that. They weren't going to show guys whipping each other and spanking each other's rear ends in their Speedos. Okay, they selectively chose not to put those pictures. Instead, every single photo is just perfect lighting, perfect makeup, just these wonderful, warm, smiling, happy people who could be your neighbors, right? This is an example of the kind of marketing campaign that has gone on in our culture to normalize and bring about the acceptance of homosexuality. And it's been this kind of a thing. So I'll pass this around if anybody wants to get some closer looks at it. If you see the funny looking picture of me there with my infamous shirt. But anyway, we went up there and we blocked the doors of City Hall. About 10 of us went up there into that Sodom and Gomorrah Festival, and we barged in there and just sat down in front of the doors and pushed them all back and said, no, ain't doing this anymore, until we got hauled out of there by the sheriffs. And the sheriffs liked us, and they sent us back in. They said, if you guys want to do this tomorrow, we'll get more media in there. And the sheriffs loved us. So they let us go back in there and do it again the next day, and we caused this big spectacle. And then the following day after that, Schwarzenegger, the governor, shut the whole thing down and ended it. Yep. So that was a pretty cool thing, but it was probably about the scariest I've been in my life. I thought I was going to get fed to the lions, but it was fun. And but that's a perfect example. You know, I've always kept that little magazine because it really just shows the power of media. So you know, some Christian groups have gotten smart about this. Proposition 8. You guys are familiar with Proposition 8 in California and what happened there. That was California voted to ban gay marriage. And it was Proposition 8, a huge battle. It was not expected to pass, but it did. And the Mormons, some other groups, a lot of Latino groups, got behind it, and it won. And so, you know, of course, the homosexuals went nuts there just a couple years ago. I mean, they were vandalizing buildings. They were going nuts. And that's been going on since the 80s. They pretty much ran every decent church out of San Francisco in the 80s with throwing, you know, running into congregations, throwing urine on congregants, running into congregations with AIDS-infected needles and threatening to stick priests and pastors who would preach a sermon against Christianity, and police officers did nothing. They said, we're not going to, you know, police officers said, we're not getting stuck with AIDS. It was a huge AIDS epidemic at this time. Thousands and thousands and thousands of gay men were dying all over this country. And nobody knew a lot about AIDS, and there was this tremendous fear of homosexuals and AIDS. And so any church in San Francisco that was preaching against homosexuality, they had their building vandalized. They had these throngs of raving homosexuals come in there and literally throwing vats and buckets of urine onto people and breaking windows out, again, sticking people with AIDS-infected needles, and there was really nothing done. And so churches just left. They just moved out to the suburbs. And so you're hard-pressed to find a church in San Francisco today that will speak against homosexuality. But that was militant in the 80s. They decided that wasn't working for them nationwide, and that's when in the 90s they switched to a more family-friendly face. Many of these people have infiltrated higher education. They understand the importance and the power of higher education. And many of them infiltrated higher education, whereas Christians, you know, tended to stay within more mainstream, kind of free market kinds of things, right? You know, we go into the corporate world or we go into the ministry world. Many of these liberals went into, you know, they saw government as something to be infiltrated, expand the power and coercion of government, and get jobs as the coercer, right? And so state education, state higher education became major vehicles to promote a lot of this stuff. And again, this is where the Christian worldview was really eroded. It was in the university, in a battle of ideas. Christianity was losing. And all these people that are graduating from college, so many of them saw in college a major shift in their worldview. And it's amazing the statistics of the number of people who enter college, you know, as Christian conservatives and leave as liberal atheists. It is overwhelming. And it's not by accident. It's not because they just have better arguments. It's because it's tremendous indoctrination. And a huge part of indoctrination, and this is very, very out in the open, this is not something that is a conspiracy theory, is that college is supposed to be a place of sexual license, sexual escapade. And this was written about very freely and very openly by many, many people who are not Christians. That, hey, when you're in college, that's the time to have fun. And you're finally out of the house. You finally got freedom. You're around a bunch of beautiful women. And everybody wants to be loose and happy and free and explore and experiment. And that's a huge part of why so many enter conservative Christians and leave as liberal atheists. Because you can't be a Christian and run off to the frat parties and pursue the drunk ladies that want to give you things, right? And vice versa. And so that is a huge tool of power and seduction to bring about change in belief within people. And it's important to understand all this. And we want to get down to the root of the problem. So just to quickly summarize, this has been a battle that's been going on for a long time in our culture to essentially overthrow Christian sexual ethics and to overthrow the Christian belief system. And I think the battle to overthrow Christian sexual ethics trumps or is more important to many than overthrowing Christianity in general. People don't necessarily have a problem with Christianity. As you see, there are gay churches. There, you know, President Obama speaks in many churches. So the issue is the moral claims that God makes over the lives of individuals, and particularly their sex lives. If we present to people a Christianity that says you can enjoy all the sexual activity you want to enjoy and just, man, live it up because God loves you and He wants you happy. And so we just tell them there's just a good God up there and Jesus was just a good loving man. He just loves you and loves everybody else. And do what makes you feel good and God will bless that. The majority of this country will readily accept that. The issue here is really the fundamental claims that God's law, which flows out of His character, His very nature, His holiness. When we understand God's holiness, this is what people have issue with. It is fundamentally an attack upon God's character and His nature, right? But it's as it is related to how God has created us and designed us and expects us to behave sexually. We essentially live in a generation now that is really the equivalent of spoiled brats. And so much of what we see in our pop culture is really nothing more than temper tantrums by grown-ups. And the way that people talk and think and act towards God is really fundamentally, it is analogous, it is similar to, it is the exact kind of thing is what you see when you see your three-year-old pitch a fit and say, you don't love me because you won't give me the cookies, right? And that's essentially what we are dealing with. What kind of a God would tell me that I cannot just love who I want to love, right? And this is the attitude, and this is where we are, and it has been bolstered and promoted by the powers that be, those who have infiltrated our government, who have infiltrated areas of power, and now the pillars that shape the value systems of our nation, the mass media, our education system, our government institutions have been infiltrated and taken over by people who think precisely this way. And so sex to them is a powerful tool. If you want to sell products and make money off people, do you want to try to sell to people who are, you know, like the stoic Germans, you know, of Wisconsin, who don't buy anything, you know? Do you want to sell to people who are wise, self-disciplined, who don't need very much, who are content with little? Are you going to be able to sell a lot of crap to those kinds of people? No. Right? If you want to sell things to people, you want to make money, you sell things. You want a population that is weak-minded, easily manipulated, sexually addicted, and you can sell them anything you want to sell them. And that's who we are as a culture today. And it's all accommodated. And leading the charge, of course, is probably the greatest corporate power in the world today, which is Google. You guys know that Google launched a campaign, a worldwide campaign to end homophobia? You guys know that? So Google is are the power in the world today. The driving force behind the digital world today. They are monopolizing many industries. They are buying out hundreds of robotics companies and information technology companies to produce really the creatures and the vehicles and the means of communication and exchange of goods for the future.
They worldwide campaigns
to end homophobia. It's called the Legalize Love Initiative. Legalize love. Doesn't that sound sweet? What kind of person would make love illegal? That's so terrible. Narrow-minded Christians. So this is the Legalize Love campaign to promote human rights and tackle employment discrimination in countries with anti-gay laws on the books, Google said in a written statement, according to CNN. The campaign will eventually expand to every country where the company has an office. But first, we'll focus on places with homophobic cultures where anti-gay laws exist. Singapore and Poland is where they launched this. Singapore and Poland. Singapore, this is what one of their executives say, Singapore wants to be a global financial center and world leader. But we can push them on the fact that being a global center and a world leader means you have to treat all people the same, irrespective of their sexual orientation. So you want to be a major player in the world scene, you want to have a major corporation, you want to be a world leader, you had better bow to the God, the idol of sexual idolatry, right? So think of what this means for families, for churches, for family-owned businesses, for corporate America, for local governments. Again, it is disastrous. So homosexuals know and they understand Christian sexual ethics are incompatible with their agenda. Incompatible. Many Christians, particularly evangelical churches, where many times the pulpits lack fortitude, lack depth of intellectual strength, right? Because the more you exercise your mind, that's powerful. And ministers of old were expected to have a deep theological understanding and conviction and to stand upon sound doctrine that was worked out through the exercise of the mind and conscience. And as those things, as the power of mind and conscience, as the ministry of pulpits of basically blabbering, jelly rolls, right? Where there is little strength of heart and courage to resist evil and little ability to articulate why that evil should even be resisted, and why it's even evil in the first place. And so evangelical Christianity, for the most part, has accommodated itself to this out of either fear of persecution, misguided understanding of love and acceptance, and thinking we're going to win these people to Christ by embracing them, rather than through an understanding of repentance. Or many of them have simply been co-opted into the homosexual agenda straight up, and are actually advocates now. Advocates. Proposition 8, what I wanted to say about that, there was a lot of data and research done, and so it was a big victory for pro-family people, although the courts overturned it. Just this last year, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, finally struck down the promoters of Proposition 8's position, and so that was blocked successfully, then overthrown by a judge, and now gay marriage has the door open to go forward, even though twice in the last decade they voted that they didn't want gay marriage, 2001, and they did it again in 2012. No, that was the United States Supreme Court. Yep, the Ninth Circuit judge suspended it and said that it was an unconstitutional, a violation of the rights of gay people. And so the people who support and pass Proposition 8 challenged that, and it went to the United States Supreme Court. Was heard by the United States Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision. The court said that the promoters of Proposition 8 to ban gay marriage did not have proper standing to be even challenging that. And so federal judge at that point, there was a stay on gay marriages that was lifted. So so even though in California the majority of the population has voted twice and said we don't want it, it's been forced on them by a federal judge. And 5 members of our Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, upheld that. So here's what they found in Proposition 8, because they had some really smart people running that campaign. They really did a lot of data analysis. They found there was what do you think is the primary thing that shifted people who had been conservative Christians and against gay marriage, shifted them over? What do you think was the number one thing that shifted them to embrace gay marriage?
God said, love your neighbors, friends.
That was a part of it.
Knowing somebody who is a homosexual.
Right, knowing somebody, having a family member or somebody close to them, somebody they worked with, somebody who you know, kind of won their heart. So this kind of campaign of let's just love people, be friendly, let's put on this family-friendly face, go into the workplace and you buy donuts for everybody, right? Going to the work, you know, it's kind of what a lot of evangelical seeker-friendly churches are doing. They're kind of following that model, you know. We're just going to love them. We're going to buy them water. And so, you know, this is what they're doing. You know, they go into the workplace and, hey, guys, I just wanted to buy you all some donuts, six-pack of beer for all the guys that work here. And I just want you to know, love you, right? And so, gosh, that's the sweetest little guy. How could you be mad at him, you know? But nobody knows what these guys do on the weekend, right? So here, now, they also found another important thing. What was the number one thing, because they had a lot of this, that caused people who, because they actually saw a shift where a lot of people moved to the side of anti-gay marriage through a lot of the work they were doing and the campaigning they were doing. They were changing a lot of people's minds who were either indifferent or maybe kind of pro-homosexual, pro-homosexual marriage. So what do you think is the number one thing that was a tipping point that brought people who had embraced same-sex marriage to then turn against same-sex marriage? What do you think the number one thing was for them? Got a genius back there.
Watching
a gay pride parade, or being exposed to a gay pride parade or festival. That was the number one thing that turned people. So that's basically having the veneer lifted, right? That's, you know, the gay pride parade is just raw, unleashed, home, you know, seeing, you know, like we saw this year at Pride Fest, right at the front door. They're selling literally penis-shaped lollipops.
Oh.
And this is just right at the front gate. Kids are walking past this. Guys are purchasing this and enjoying this right in front of their children.
Oh. We should all invite someone to that parade.
You should, you know. That was the single biggest thing they found out in California. That was the, you know, all this data analysis for the people that ran that campaign. They found out that was the single biggest thing that turned people away from homosexuality. Embracing
the
it.
Issue of being born that way, wasn't that the myth?
Oh, that, you know, that's up there. We'll get into that later in later sessions as far as all their rhetoric. I mean, they got so many little things. I mean, most people still to this day do not believe homosexuals were born that way. And really, that's kind of a moot issue. You know, I mean, to me, it's like, what if they were? So what? We're all born sinners. We're all born broken. We're all born, you know, flawed. You know, like I said, we all threw temper tantrums as kids. Temper tantrums are just as natural as anything else, but it's not right. Part of being a mature person is you learn how to control natural desires and impulses. That's what the word mature essentially means, right? So to say that because you have a natural desire, therefore you automatically have a right to fulfill that desire is essentially to say that self-discipline, self-restraint, maturity shouldn't exist or does not exist, right? But anyway, so that was the number one thing that they discovered in Prop 8, and So, to summarize up to this point, again, all this really goes back to a war of ideas. If we're going to win this, it goes back to us understanding the issues, understanding our enemy, understanding how they think, the ideas and strategies that they have advanced, and being able to rip the foundation out of that, right? And so the antidotes, I believe, are one, Christians who have a robust, intellectually strong worldview and can articulate it. Christians who know what they believe and can articulate that persuasively, who have sound, rational, intellectual grounding for their belief system, and we can articulate that clearly. That's powerful. That's powerful. The stereotype that is prevalent in our world, and a lot of it has been advanced by Hollywood itself. Of course, movies like, what was the one down there at the Scopes Monkey Trial? Inherit the Wind, if anybody's ever seen that film, unbelievable propaganda that was just mind-bogglingly ridiculous, yet was extremely powerful. That film is laughable, caricature of Christianity, and yet it's shown still to this day at universities, to university students. So the stereotype is that Christians are idiots, they cannot defend what they believe, we're shallow, we have blind faith. We just dogmatically impose our Neanderthal ideas on others. And so that's what we have to dismantle. A Christian who stands up and articulates a Christian worldview, the beauty of marriage, the strength of marriage, The beauty of Christian civilization produced by adherence to God's law, the rationality of understanding our Creator, who He is, His justice, His holiness, that our rights, our values come from Him. When men stand up and articulate this, this is powerful. This is persuasive. And this is crucial to us becoming, you know, we can bash homosexuality, and that's fine, but ultimately, if we're going to win this thing, we've got to get to the root, and that is putting Christianity back on the map as an intellectually viable alternative to the garbage that has been foisted upon the minds of generations, where Christianity has been reduced to something that is mythological, irrational, foolish to believe. And so we need to take that back. We need to take back that ground we've lost. And there are great Christian scholars now to this day that are penetrating the institutions of higher learning, getting into academia, and doing a great job fighting those battles. But we need to be able to do that on the street. We need to be able to do that in the workplace. You need to be able to do that with your family members. Yeah, we don't want to be reactionary and come across as kooks, right? Yeah, some of the most articulate, most intellectually sophisticated Christian men I've ever lived were burned at the stake, or had their heads cut off. Being able to articulate yourself and be persuasive. But ultimately, though, we need to do that, right? We don't want to say, well, I'm going to get persecuted, so kind of it doesn't matter. We don't want to fall into that error of saying, you know what, it doesn't matter how I present myself or how well I can defend my position. They reject it because they're evil, and I get a free pass to not do my homework or my research and be able to present myself properly in a way that I'm